Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solomon on Blast and a Shana Tova to everyone. In case your Hebrew is a little rusty, that means Happy New Year in Hebrew. Yes, it is the new year already, 2016. We were out last week, in case you were listening and wondering why you were hearing Fox News or Fox Sports instead. That wasn't our original plan. We were trying to line up a special guest, but couldn't do it at the last minute. And so we were unable to replay a show from before Christmas, so you all got Fox Sports. My apologies for the confusion. Not exactly the wisdom of Solomon from Fox Sports, but not to worry. We're back to start the new year. At least I am. Fred's out sick this morning, so it'll just be myself. And we're going to start by looking at the new year, maybe look at the past a little bit too. When Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun, I think one of the areas he's referring to is how we as people, our human nature, so to speak, views the past. There's a fairly universal viewpoint that prevails among people throughout all of the ages, and that is that the past was better than the present. Why else would there be so much nostalgia regarding the so-called good old days? We have a tendency to think that the economy was better. On average, more people got more wealth and riches, and they lived in better and simpler times. People complain now how current times are so much more complicated and that we live in uncertain and hectic times. So when it comes to the past, we have a tendency to look at it more favorably than we look at the present. But Solomon's wisdom has a different take on that view completely. In Ecclesiastes 7:10, he says, "Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this." Solomon understood this attitude in human nature and admonishes us that it's not a wise approach to how we live life, mainly because for the most part, people are ignorant of those former days. Ask young people today if they have any idea what things were like even 40 years ago. They have no idea in reality, but if they could find and understand what things were like, they would see that human nature hasn't changed at all. There's always been foolish, wicked, and evil people, and if you ask people that do understand what it was like 40 years ago, because they lived in it, I don't think there's anybody that really wants to go back to those supposed good old days. If you look back just to 1976, 40 years ago, and realize there were no cell phones at that point, let alone smartphones, you had one phone in the house, and it was probably bolted to the wall with a really long cord on it for the handset, just so you could move a little bit beyond where the phone was at. Apple Computer was actually started in 1976, 40 years ago, so there weren't any Apple products back then. Sorry, all you guys, no anything. In fact, there weren't even personal computers, although you could get one of those really cool electronic calculators back then. You had three major TV networks, maybe some of the other minor local stations, but Ted Turner's WTBS Superstation was available on cable for the first time in 1976. And the real benefit, maybe, more than 75% of those televisions in homes were able to receive color on one or more sets. So the VHS tape was actually just coming on the market in 1976. So you had a little bit of flexibility there rather than just those going to the regular movies. The reliability, quality of American and Japanese cars in the mid-70s, 40 years ago, versus those today. Medical technology is much better now than it was 40 years ago, and people are living longer. If you need proof, just look at life insurance rates and mortality tables. I could go on and on, but I think you get my point. Maybe socially, those were the good old days, but from an economic and technology perspective, they were far from what we have available today and what the future holds. So I think Solomon is right. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? I think we have much, much better technology, a lot more opportunities today than we did back then. So what can we look forward to for 2016? Well, we of course, have the presidential election coming up this year. Not sure I want to make any predictions on that other than it will be about the economy. It always is, one way or the other. The Fed will inflate. They always do. Will there be a recession in 2016, or will the election push that recession out into 2017? That's a little harder to answer. Who knows what technology breakthroughs we'll look back on in 40 years and be amazed at, although I will make one prediction from a technology standpoint, and that is that IBM will be at the top of the list for the total number of patents for 2015 and probably 2016 also. The list for 2015 isn't out yet. It usually comes out in the middle of January. But given they've been number one for the past 22 years straight, and having worked for them, contributed to that list in the past, I'd say it's a sure bet they'll be number one again. It is one of their goals in their business division for the patent law that they be number one every year, and they make a lot of money off of that. So the state of the world for 2016 in general, I think that one's fairly easy. I'll let Solomon give you the answer there, Ecclesiastes 1:9. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. But there is nothing new under the sun. So at least not when it comes to human nature anyways. One quick prediction. It is time for a commercial break. We'll be right back with more of Solomon on Blast. Job ought to get it. One shot, no, we quit it. One for the road. All right, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. If you want to give us a call, 750-7456, and give us your predictions for 2016, possibly. One of the things I think that is going to be pretty significant going into 2016 is the whole immigration issue in Europe, actually, not here in the United States. It may be in the United States, but I think it's going to be pretty significant in Europe as well, and maybe even more so. There was an article that came out just around Christmas time that says Israel reports record immigration of Jews from France in 2015. And it says that a record number of French Jews had moved to Israel this year, citing a lot of anti-Semitic violence and economic insecurity in the European country as causes. So France has a large Jewish population in Europe. It's grown, having grown by nearly half since World War II to some 550,000 people. The community has been impacted by the increased security threats, Islamist militant attacks such as the January of 2015 killing in the Paris market after the Charlie Hebdo shooting. Israel quasi-governmental Jewish agency, which encourages immigration, said some 7,900 French Jews had relocated to Israel in 2015, which was a 10% increase from the previous year. Each has her own reason, including the economic crisis, personal security, terrorist attacks, and in some places and times, an anti-Jewish mood, according to their spokesman. Though not final, they say that those figures actually fall short of what they predicted. They predicted somewhere around 10,000 people. But I think that this is going to be significant in other countries in Europe as well. The big issue is probably more so going to be in Western Europe. There's a good chance that a year from now there'll be a lot of hand-wringing and consternation regarding the events of 2016 with respect to Western Europe's allowing immigrants coming in from these Muslim countries. If you look at one of the comments or the writings from Saul Alinsky, his one statement is, the action is the reaction, and I think the action is pretty clear at least over the past year, and that is there's been a very decentralized approach to these immigrations, and it's not really any specific conspiracy, I would say. The flow of immigrants out of these failed countries is dominated by Muslims. They are Muslims that are fleeing Muslims themselves. These are Muslims trying to get into Western Europe before they effectively close the doors on it. They realize, I think, that the clock is ticking. Time's running out. If barbed wire fences go up before they can get in and out of these other states, they're going to have to spend the rest of their lives in these failed conditions. And they don't want to do this. And I guess I don't think you can really blame them from that aspect. Hungary has put up a fence, but it won't do much good for Europe. If you look at the various routes into Western Europe, the countries are small and there's a way around national fences. And that's pretty obvious that nothing yet has been done to really stop the flow of these immigrants coming in. Meanwhile, in Brussels, you know, the bureaucrats and the politicians who run the European Union really don't know what to do. They've officially been in favor of multiculturalism for years. That is the whole approach to the EU. They've been in favor of open borders, where residents of any EU country can move into the jurisdiction of any other EU country. Now, when you look at it, it's creating a pretty big problem. Once a refugee gets inside the borders of any EU country, he is legally allowed to go into any other EU country. Obviously, they're going to head to the places that have the best economic conditions. They're going to want to go into Germany. The economy there is not quite in a recession. They want to get into Great Britain. They obviously want to avoid all of the Club Med countries, Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal. The EU politicians, bureaucrats are officially in favor of exactly what is happening. But when you look at it from a domestic political point of view, there's a lot of the politicians making a lot of gains with the commentary that they want to close the borders now. I mean, France did that after the shootings there. So there was a comment one time made by Tip O'Neill, the old Speaker of the House, where he says all politics is local, and the bureaucrats and the politicians in the EU really aren't in charge at the local level. They only can pretend that they are. The people in charge are really the local politicians there. Local politicians can ignore, thumb their noses at the EU, and they really don't have any way at the higher level of enforcing these decisions that they are trying to make. It doesn't have an army, obviously, to be able to enforce it. It can't impose any really significant negative sanctions to overcome the political movement in any EU country. Just look at what happened with Greece. There's an illusion that the central government in Europe really has this kind of power, but it doesn't. It really has no control over it. The wave of immigration is going to continue, you know, through the winter, probably escalate in the spring, just like it has in the past. If nothing's done to stop it, Northern Europe is probably going to be inundated, and Germany's going to get another million or so refugees. They'll head to, like I say, some of these other fiscally solvent or economically beneficial nations, Holland, Austria, even places like Sweden. There's a number of cases of Muslim immigrants in Sweden attacking people for basically anti-Muslim behaviors. And it doesn't show up in the news a lot, but it's even happening in these, shall we say, politically neutral countries like Sweden. So in terms of the existing European Union rules, there really isn't anything that these nations are legally allowed to do about it, but they can put up fences and they can stop letting the immigrants come into these countries. So is there a good chance that more fences will go up this summer? Hungary may not be alone in that, but I don't think there's going to be a really concerted effort to block them. They'll continue coming into Europe this year. And I think what that really does is it calls into question the whole EU experiment that has been going on for years. The EU doesn't know what to do about it. Hungary has paved the way with putting up its fence. And what has the EU done about that? It hasn't really done anything about it. Hungary's proved this time what it proved in the 1980s, that fences are important. Back then, the barriers went down. Anybody in the Eastern Bloc countries who got into Hungary could get into Austria. Now the fences are going back up, but it's not to keep people in this time. It's more so to keep them out. And these political parties that are in favor of opening the borders are going to probably find a lot of opposition in Europe over the next year or a few years as the elections come up. And it's a good chance that 2016 is going to be a year in which, you know, push comes to shove. The EU may have to make a decision and either decide to close the borders or force some of these other countries like Hungary to take down fences. And if it tries to sit on the fence, so to speak, the fence is probably going to collapse there. The European Union, you know, was a brainchild of a gentleman by the name of Jean Monnet, and a lot of people financed him back in almost 100 years ago. And it's been continuing to try and extend its jurisdiction over nations, elections, and I think possibly we'll see a change with respect to that in 2016. Nationalism is basically going to come back against what a lot of people would say is the new world order in Europe. And it's a good chance this will be visible by the end of 2016. The voters are going to see the invasion for what it really is, an invasion. It's not just standard immigration. But the problem is it's not a cohesive invasion. It's really kind of decentralized. It's individuals that are coming in. They want to bring their Islamic worldviews with them, but they don't want to live under the rule of the people who claim to be defenders of the traditional Islam. So in some sense, these people are somewhat schizophrenic, if you think about it. You know, they don't want to live in the countries where they claim to defend the very religion that they're supporting and are part of. Because when you really consider it, nobody leaves your country of origin to go to a foreign country with a foreign culture unless there's a lot of pressure on you where you live, or there's a lot better opportunities in these new countries. And yeah, in some cases there are better opportunities in these countries, but for those that live under these countries where obviously things are failed, economic liberty, productivity in Europe is an overwhelming draw, but the collapse of their own countries is really what's driving them out of there. And they're getting out, and they're getting out while they still have the opportunity to do so, which may not be for very much longer. So I think this year, 2016, you'll see that there's a lot of added incentive for these people to get out of those countries. So there'll be a lot more immigration. And obviously that single fence in hungry isn't going to stop them. And every fence that does end up going up is kind of a message that to them that says they better get out now while they still can. And because this really isn't a cohesive exit, it's just going to increase the flood because it's so decentralized. I think you'll see we've seen in the past, you know, these attacks in France, and actually we're coming up just later this week on the 1 year anniversary of the attacks there in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo ones. You're going to see a lot of consternation by the EU and the bureaucrats there as to what they can do to stem these kind of problems as they continue to occur. It's really ironic that here the EU is trying to create a cohesive one Europe, and at the same time, it's the individual countries are essentially saying, no, we don't want this to happen. So it's hard to fight against something that isn't a standing army when you've got so many individuals out there. So we'll see how that plays out in the next year, but I think that is one area that there's better opportunities. People are going to take it. And how much better to get wisdom than gold, says Solomon. So we'll be back right after these commercial breaks with more Solomon on Blast.
Little bee running, having great big fun until he got the note. Saying, toe the line or blow. And that was all she wrote. He'd be making like a feline, heading for the borderline. Go. Same bottle, this and that. How much you done spend? I swear she must believe it's all hell to see. Hey, boy, you better bring a check around. To the sad, sad truth, the dirty law down.
All right, we're back. Solomon Blast here on Power Talk 1210. So what are your New Year's resolutions for this coming year? Does it make sense to make them? Lots of people make those New Year's resolutions, but what a lot of times they don't make is a New Year's retrospective, because retrospectives, at least in most cases, are more important than the resolutions, because when you look at things in retrospect, it lets you know how well you've done in the previous New Year's resolutions. And Solomon says, open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. And I think sometimes that open rebuke of, well, looking at those past resolutions and in a retrospect is a little bit of a rebuke to ourselves that says, you know, have I done what I initially said I was going to do? So you'd have to, I would probably expect that any New Year's resolutions that you've made this year probably has to do with some kind of self-improvement. I think we've gone over it before. It's typically the financial aspects and the health exercise aspects of people's lives that they make the most resolutions over. But you want to do better over the next year. That's really the main reason for them. It's a reasonable goal, but exactly 1 year from today, how will you know that you've met this goal, assuming that you meet it? Will you be able to identify the reasons for why you didn't meet your goal? Goal setting and implementation are part of a larger process, really, that and the process of achieving success. But success isn't really easy to define in all cases. So you have to define it for the specific case that you're dealing with. And once you define that success, a lot of times it's not easy to measure it. Obviously, if you're looking to lose weight, there's one way of measuring it. If you're looking for financial improvements. There are metrics there, but if it's not in those areas, what are metrics? What are the metrics you do want to use for the resolutions that you're making so that you can look at it in retrospective and really know whether you succeeded? In our economy, a lot of everything is kind of the profit and loss. It's a lot easier to, like I say, assess success than in any other system of economic organization. I think that's the inability of socialism was that it couldn't provide in reliable and meaningful metrics on its success. And so how do you really know your socialism is successful if you can't measure it economically? Because if they were to measure it economically, obviously it was a total failure. And that's really what socialism boiled down to, a total failure. So have you sat down and looked and considered what your definition of success in life is overall? To do this, you're going to have to make decisions about what your metrics are. You're going to have to make some decisions about things that you can measure, or at least make comparable objective markers in your life that will enable you to assess your progress or potentially lack of progress with respect to gaining that personal success. And if you've not done this, why not do it today? Sit down, think about how you define personal success in your life. Think about the milestones or markers that will enable you to assess your rate of progress. If you don't do it at some point, you're going to find yourself maybe on the deathbed, wondering where time went and what you have to show for it. There is one way to avoid this, though. Die unexpectedly somewhere other than on your deathbed, but that's probably not going to be considered success for the goals that you put in place. But it is good to have long-term goals. They don't do much good if you don't have some way of evaluating your progress along the timeline that you've set for yourself. So do you have a program in your own life? Can you see progress year to year? If not, then your biggest problem is not having that systematic program, which will enable you to look at your progress on a year-to-year basis. So again, I say, sit down, think about last year's resolutions, if you made any. If there were none, should there have been, potentially? If there should have been, are these related to any resolutions that you've made this year? Try to identify some area of your life in which you've had maybe measurable success over the past year. Write down the metrics, then write down the evidence that you have, which indicates you've achieved some degree of success, mainly because it helps in terms of going forward. If you can identify successes, it will help motivate you to continue those successes. If you can't do that, then I would say maybe suggest that you do it with respect to any resolutions that you've made so far this year. If you made them yesterday or today, you have to have these metrics. If you don't, you're not going to be able to evaluate come January 2017. Some people really don't want to do this for a good reason. And a lot of it psychologically, they don't think they've had any success, and a lot of times they don't want to be reminded of it. It's almost a guaranteed attitude for a lifetime of failure, though. The old slogan, if you plan to fail, you plan to fail. So that comes into play. And if you failed in the attempt to look at your performance over the last year, identify the reasons why you cannot assess it, then think about how you can avoid going through the same experience 1 year from today. If you failed to do something over last year that would enable you to assess your rate of progress, don't fail to do it this year. By going through the exercise, you'll help yourself make a better plan. progress is cumulative, so there are cumulative benefits when you have that positive feedback of seeing those successes. And at some point, there could be some exponential growth as you build up those cumulative benefits. A lot of people's projects fail. They typically fail in the first year, but those that don't fail become eligible for that exponential growth curve. And at some point, though, yeah, the growth rate may slow down, but the outcomes are usually a lot more spectacular than those that don't make it through that first year. And like I said, you know, when you really look back at it, the real big failure in socialism was the fact that they couldn't accurately indicate what was success. And it took a while, but it is good to know that that type of thing had the potential for failure and did fail, because it obviously wasn't going to and didn't result in a lot of positive improvement in anybody's life out there. So I think we start small, you get a lot of positive feedback, and things can be very much more progressive, successful as you go forward. So my recommendation, sit down, identify those milestones, maybe for the next 12 months, that'll help you assess your rate of progress, look at how you did over the last 12 months, and go forward with a plan for success rather than just make those resolutions and come next year, look back and say, well, I didn't make any of them. So some food for thought there, some wisdom from Solomon possibly. We'll be back with a little more of Solomon on Blast right after these messages here on Power Talk 1210. And we're back in town, or here on the radio, Power Talk 1210, Solomon on Blast. I made comment about the fact that, would there be a recession in 2016, or would the election kind of push it out into 2017? And there seems to be a current out there of people that believe that we are heading into a recession, even though if you listen to the Fed and their soothsayers, that they believe that the economy's doing well, but I think they just want to make sure that the economy's doing well going into the election, because, like I said at the beginning, it is about the economy, and I think the proper quotation was, it's about the economy, stupid, but it is about the economy. And there was an article related to this movie that's come out called The Big Short, which is an adaptation of Michael Lewis's book about the 2008 financial crisis. called The Big Short. And this particular article, they are talking with a gentleman by the name of Michael Burry, who was involved in the 2008 economic or financial crisis with the banks and everything. And they interviewed him and asking him what his particular outlook was on the things for 2016. He's actually head of Sky and Asset Management. And some of the questions and some of the answers I thought were fairly eye-opening. They were kind of talking with him, referring to his portrayal in the movie. And it says the movie portrays all of you as kind of swashbuckling heroes in some way. But you were very troubled by what happened. And they asked him, is that really the case? And he said, I felt I was watching a plane crash. I actually had that dream again and again. I knew what was happening, but there was nothing I or anyone else could do to stop it. He says, the last day of 2007, I couldn't go home. I was in office till late at night. I couldn't calm down. I wrote my wife an email and said, I can't come home. It's just too upsetting what's happening. I didn't want to come home to my kids like this. He says, as for punishment of those responsible, he says, borrowers were punished for their overindulgence. They lost homes and lives. Let's not forget that. But the executives at the lenders simply got rich. And so they asked him if he was surprised that nobody went to jail. He says he was shocked that executives at some of the worst lenders were not punished for what they did, but this is the nature of things. The ones running the machine did not get punished after the dot-com bubble either. All those venture capitalists and executives still live in their mansions in San Francisco. He says the little guy will pay for it, the small investor, the borrower, which is why the little guy needs to be warned to be more diligent and to be more suspicious of society's sanctioned suits offering free money. It'll always be seductive, but that's the devil that wants your soul. He says that he was, in one of the questions, the interviewer says, I was surprised to hear they thought that financial reform, a lot of the other people that were in the movie or participated in 2008 thought that the financial reform was pretty effective and the system was a lot safer, but the author of the book, Michael Lewis, disagreed, and they asked him what he thought the crash result were with regard to any kind of positive changes. And his response is, it really, unfortunately, he says there's not many that I can see. The biggest hope he had was that we'd enter a new era of personal responsibility. He says, instead, we doubled down on blaming others, and this is long-term tragic. The crisis incredibly made the biggest banks bigger, he says, and it made the Federal Reserve, an unelected body, even more powerful and therefore more relevant. The major reform legislation that Congress put through, Dodd-Frank, was named after two guys bought and sold by special interests, he says, and one of them should be shouldering a good amount of the blame for the crisis. Banks were forced by the government to save some of the worst lenders in the housing bubble. Then the government turned around and pillared the banks for the crimes of the companies they were forced to acquire. And he says that the zero interest rate policy broke the social contract for generations of hardworking Americans who save for retirement. And the interest that the Federal Reserve pays on the excess reserves of lending institutions broke the money multiplier and handcuffed lending to small and mid-sized enterprises. Government policies and regulations have aided, in his opinion, hollowing out middle America far more than the private sector had done, and making things even worse. He says, in terms of people's perception of the system, at least in the media, it appears to be one of Americans being held down by Wall Street, by big companies in the private sector, and by wealth, by the wealthy. He says, they claim capitalism is on trial. He says that he sees it differently. If a lender offers me free money, I do not have to take it. And if I take it, I better understand all the terms, because there's no such thing as free money. And again, he goes back to stating that this is really just personal responsibility and common sense. And so the interviewer asked him, well, where do we stand now economically? And this was kind of, I think, the most frightening part about it. He says, we're back at it, trying to stimulate growth through easy money. It hasn't worked, but it's the only tool that the Fed's got. Meanwhile, the Fed policies widen the wealth gap, which feeds political extremism, forcing gridlock in Washington. It seems the world is headed toward negative real interest rates on a global scale, which is toxic. And he says interest rates are used to price risks. So in the current environment, the risk pricing mechanism is broken, and that's not healthy. We're building up terrific stresses in the system and any fault lines that will certainly harm the outlook. He says debt is really the thing he's most nervous about for the future. The idea that growth will remedy our debt is kind of what's been addictive the politicians, but in the end, the citizens really pay the price. And so he says that really he sees the housing market basically going into the same environment that it was in the past. They're the low interest rates, lending to people that really can't afford these things, and that in the end, it's going to result in the same thing it did back in 2007, 2008. And that's one of the reasons that people are seeing this as a problem when it comes to the economy going forward into 2016. And like I said, maybe the only thing that might not cause it to happen in 2016 is the fact that we do have a presidential election coming up, and typically the overall economy is good in those years and falls in the following year. But that allows the newly elected president to blame everything on the past one. So we'll probably see that happen again, as usual. And along those lines, I was looking at some of the polling numbers for the Republican presidential candidates. So this is maybe a little bit of a look at the predictions for 2016 presidential candidates. And it's a very good chance that I think based on at least current polling, Donald Trump has definitely got a good chance there. The one thing that I thought was interesting is that the numbers from this particular survey showed that Donald Trump was obviously in the lead, somewhere around almost 30% of the respondents. This particular poll had about 1,041 respondents, and 29.8, almost 30% of those were possible candidate would be Donald Trump. Ted Cruz was 9.6, Ben Carson 8.6, Marco Rubio was down at 5.7. This was a December 22nd poll, and Jeb Bush way down at 4.8. The one thing that you had to kind of unfilter the results from, this was off the Reuters site, because it was actually a filtered poll that they were posting that only showed about 600 of the respondents. So there's about 400 of the respondents in there that wasn't shown. Well, when you unfiltered this, it turns out that those other 400 wouldn't vote. That's 24% of the respondents on this poll said they wouldn't even vote. So the wouldn't vote numbers were much higher than what Ted Cruz had, what Ben Carson and Marco Rubio all had, which tells me that with Donald Trump at 30% and 24% of the people saying they won't even vote, it kind of leaves things pretty much wide open for Donald Trump if there's a lot of these people that aren't going to vote going into the primaries and aren't going to vote for Donald Trump. But basically what that says is, anything but Hillary. So they're not even going to vote because that would be the other choice. And I think as we go into 2016 here and the elections, there could be a lot of those people that continue that aspect of we won't vote, but how that plays out for Donald coming into, if he does get the nomination, how that would play out for him against Hillary, that could be an interesting approach. It is probably going to be one of the most interesting years we've seen in a long time when it comes to a presidential election. And we also, just so happens, happen to have the Olympics this year, so that'll keep people entertained for a short period of time. And those Olympics are actually going to be in South America, in Rio de Janeiro this year, in Brazil, first time ever for Olympics in the Southern Hemisphere. But, so those are my predictions, kind of look ahead for the year. We'll probably be back again next week with more Solomon Blast. So until then, keep thinking wisely.
Whether near or far away, may you find that long-awaited golden day today. May your troubles all be small ones, and your fortune May the good Lord